Colin, we can't actually say the title of your book on the radio, thanks to the FCC. Right, yes. So just so we don't have to add a whole bunch of bleeps to the interview, we could use mind freak, which is maybe kind of close. Or is there another radio-friendly word you like?
I used to call it MF.
Okay, MF, that
MF,
works.
Yeah. Okay. MFing, MF.
Okay, we'll try that. Well, so what exactly is an MF?
MF is a type of action that somebody performs on another person where they try to interfere with that person's mind, make them do things against their own best interests or against their own best reason, and in such a way as to cause emotional upheaval.
There are a bunch of different variations on this, though. I mean, that makes it sound very negative, but you begin the book by describing at least a few ways in which MFing can be sort of pleasurable, like, classic movies like The Matrix or The Fight Club, you know, would have a kind of mind-blowing twist ending.
Exactly, yes. So there's the positive and negative species of the MF. And I think that the negative kinds are the more dominant ones, and they're more interesting ones. But at the same time, there do seem to be cases where people speak of being MF'd by a film that they liked very much. It means one in which their expectations were led in a certain direction, and they firmly believed that certain things were going on in the film. And then suddenly, like in The Usual Suspects, something happens that upsets all those expectations. And they find it thrilling. There's a kind of frisson of surprise. And sometimes it can be quite extreme where a person suddenly reverses everything that they've thought before. So there are the positive kinds of MF. I talk about them in the course of the book. Even philosophy I describe as a little bit of MF going on in that, because it can lead to these, in this case, pleasurable, at least, or intellectually stimulating upheavals of thought. And most people enjoy that. It's possible, of course, to find those things distressing. At the same time, many people find skepticism distressing, but many don't.
So is this why you got interested in the subject from a philosophical standpoint? Because
it's very much from a philosophical standpoint. In fact, my little book, it's only a very short book, is really a book in analytic philosophy. It's about the analysis of the concept of MF. I talk about certain instances of it, but I'm interested in saying what's involved in the concept in the very nature of the MFing act or the result of the MF. So I'm a philosopher, of course, and so that's what interested me about it. Linguistically, the phrase is rather interesting and odd, of course, because it contains these two parts, mind and then another part, which I can't really say on the radio. But they don't usually get put together in that way. So the phrase has a kind of dissonance built into it, unlike the phrase bullshit, which is a different one that Harry Frankfurt wrote about. I got interested through that. A specific reason was I gave a lecture in New York many years ago now about the mind-body problem, and I was proposing a certain kind of view which was found by many people to be rather revolutionary and surprising. And somebody afterwards said to me, that was a real MF, and I'd never actually heard the phrase before, and I instantly knew what it meant.
It's a dubious compliment.
I knew what was in the lecture. I could see what they had in mind, and I thought, what a strange phrase, and it lingered around, knocked around in my mind for a while, and then for some reason one day I thought it might be good to think about this phrase and try to spell out what's behind it. So that's how I got interested in it.
It is a strange and kind of interesting phrase, but I'm curious why you find it philosophically interesting.
Well, it's philosophically interesting in somewhat the same way that bullshit is interesting. You're trying to say what's involved in, say, Harry Frankfurt was interested in what's involved in the difference between lying and bullshitting. Lying is a case where a person intentionally gets another person to believe a falsehood by making that person think that you, the speaker, believes the thing that you're lying about. So bullshitting, if you had just looked at it without much analysis, you would think it was much the same thing, but actually it's different. And so Frankfurt pointed out that really the bullshitter is somebody who is indifferent to the truth, just uses the truth or uses the false either way in order to get whatever he wants to do, which usually is to create a good impression. So the idea of the MF is similar in that respect. It involves the idea of falsity. So I use the example of Shakespeare's Othello, where Iago is convincing Othello of many false things about his wife, Desdemona. So you might think, is MFing then just a type of lying? But no, it's a little bit more interesting than that. because it involves particularly the idea of disturbing somebody's emotions and then maybe even driving them into a kind of breakdown, which happens with Othello. So it's just philosophically interesting to see the distinctions there.
So it sounds like one of the things you're doing is kind of creating almost a taxonomy of different forms of deception.
That's exactly right, yes.
So it sounds like there's the lie, which is the simplest form of deception.
Right.
It's just a straight-up substituting one truth for another.
Right. Yeah, well, BSing, falsehood, yeah.
Yeah. BSing, on the other hand, is something a little more complex.
BSing is a little bit more complex because the person's relation to the truth is a little bit different than in the case of the lie. In the case of the lie, the person's relation to the truth is they want to conceal it. In the case of the BSer, then the relation of the person to the truth is that they're indifferent. They don't really care whether what they say is true or false. This is according to Frankfurt's analysis, which I don't necessarily agree with. The MFer, though, is again a bit different. In typical cases, the MFer is somebody who wishes to put across a falsehood to somebody, like in the case of Iago and Othello, but perhaps not in every case. So even in the case of the films which involve an MF, there's falsehoods are being foisted onto the audience, in this case, in order to produce an aesthetic effect. So there's another strange relation to the truth. What's different with lying and the BSing case is the MF is much more sinister than that. It's usually trying to undermine or destroy the other person, harm them in various ways. That's what makes it a bit different.
Yeah, when I think of the word MF, the term, I tend to think it means somebody's playing mind games with you. You know, that expression, somebody's messing with your head in a way
that is
deliberately manipulative or deliberately deceptive. There's something a little sinister about it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the same. These are rough synonyms, aren't they, of the MF, the playing with one's head, messing with somebody's mind, and so on. The idea of the MF, though, is a much more emphatic phrase and a sort of pungent phrase that captures, I think, some of the immorality of the negative MF. You know, playing with somebody's head, it sounds like a kind of a nice thing to do. But if you're thinking of, you know, very despicable propaganda about something, you know, trying to stereotype a race or something of that sort, like Nazi propaganda. Then, of course, you say that you're playing with people's heads seems very much an understatement.
There's something aggressive about it.
Aggressive about it, exactly. It's aggressive. It's directed to the mind. It's like raping the mind almost. It's manipulation, but even that is a relatively weak word. Hmm. Assaulting the mind in some way. That's really, I think, what the word MF tries to bring out, the strong character of this kind of manipulation.
What's the first historical case you can think of involving MFing?
Well, as I say in my book, you can take it back to Plato and the Sophists, where really the idea of sophistry is very like the idea of the MF. And in the case of Plato and the Sophists were people who rented out their skills in convincing people of various things. So if you wanted to, if you were on trial for something or something of that sort, you'd hire one of these sophists and they would come in to defend you, and they could use any means whatever. So they would manipulate the jury, they would appeal to prejudices, they would use fallacies, they would use any trick in the book in order to win the case. It's not much the same now with law. I mean, there's nobody's, the idea of going by the truth and not manipulating the jury, you know, no lawyer does that. They do whatever they can. So Plato found that rather deplorable, and he wanted to advocate strict reason. In other words, you only persuade people of things by appealing to logic, evidence, and so forth. So he was opposed to the sophists, and I think ever since Plato there's been that division within Western civilization between the Platonists, who the believers in reason, and the sophists, who are more like politicians or lawyers, who use any emotional means, push any buttons, play with any minds, whatever phrase we use, in order to achieve a certain end. In other words, they don't really care about the truth, and success for them is a matter of just of winning.
No, it's the concept of spin.
It's like the concept of spin is very similar. I think that's a good analogy. We use a strange word to try to capture it. I mean, spin is what the ball does when it goes through the air. So we have this idea of political spin, Well, you're trying to create an impression. You're not doing it. The idea is not to present objectively the evidence to the audience. The idea is to sort of try to trick them in some way, manipulate them. That kind of idea.
There's another flavor or aspect of MFing, and that has to do with the sort of disorienting effect it produces. I was interested in looking at your book. You also describe paradigm shifts as a kind of MF. I don't know. How so?
Yeah. Well, in the paradigm shift, Thomas Kuhn's concept of the paradigm shift, the idea is people are sort of sailing smoothly along, accepting the standard scientific framework, you know, so they're accepting the view that the Earth is the centre of the universe, let's say. And then somebody comes along, Copernicus and Kepler and so on, and they persuade us that actually, given the evidence when it's properly gathered, this paradigm, as Kuhn called it, is false, is wrong. And so, but this paradigm is very deeply embedded into people's thinking about themselves and the universe, because obviously it has a religious basis. So to be told that actually the Earth is not the centre of the universe at all, but is only one tiny speck in a vast cosmos, was experienced by the people at that time as very threatening and very upsetting, and changed their whole conception of what human beings are, their relation to God, if there is such a relation. And so it's not surprising in a way that this kind of paradigm shift, as he calls it, leads to emotional upheaval, and people find it difficult to switch their beliefs in such a basic way. Is it very similar to just people who grow up, say, with being Catholics, and at some point they start to question their religious faith? They don't just suddenly switch overnight without any emotional anguish over to an atheistic point of view, let's say. Rather, its experience is very disorienting to them, and it's a difficult thing for them to achieve.
Well, and getting back to that, the concept of the aggression involved, no wonder people who feel a particular paradigm shift, loss of faith or whatever, if they feel MF'd by the whole situation, no wonder they react in such a hostile way.
That's a good point, I think. Often this kind of thing produces hostility and it produces reaction, and often it will produce persecution of those who cause the upheaval. And Galileo was a good example of that. So you have to be careful if you produce a paradigm shift and you question accepted or received opinion, that you'll be demonized and people will hate you because you've disturbed them. One thing people don't like is to be disturbed in their basic thoughts. They like to think that they've got it all figured out and nobody can tell them what's what. People found Socrates very disturbing for that, exactly the same reason. He wandered around the place questioning people. People were quite confident in their opinions, and he showed them that their confidence was groundless. And people didn't always react to that favorably. They were often quite angry at Socrates. Of course, he came to a sticky end with the hemlock.
Right. Of course, people like Socrates and Galileo were, you know, doing whatever they did with the best of intentions. But
yeah,
there are plenty of cases of MFing in which the perpetrators do not have remotely noble intentions. And you write that in some ways you sort of see this as a kind of higher order form of deception, that it takes actual skill to pull off an MF.
It does. I mean, go back to the case of Othello again. I mean, Iago is extremely skillful because it's inherently a risky thing to do, because if you're manipulating the truth and misleading people, they might find out that you're doing it and then you get in trouble. So Iago is on a tightrope, but he has to play it very carefully. And in key scenes in the play, Iago is pulling Othello along by the nose, as he says, and he has to be very careful not to overdo it at a certain point, because then Othello will suspect him. So he takes Othello along a path and he breaks him down, and so at each subsequent stage of this breakdown, he can go further and try to undermine Othello even more than he has before. So it is a skillful thing. That's why these spinmeisters in politics are people who are quite highly paid to do this. They're good at coming up with slogans. They're good at coming up with spin, as you call them. And so, yes, it's a fairly skillful thing. The sophists were quite skillful in their way.
Mm. In Othello, one of the things that's so sinister and mind-boggling about what Iago does to Othello is he could have just killed him. You know, if he didn't like him,
yeah,
he could have just,
yeah,
they were,
yeah,
out on battlefields together. He could have,
right,
arranged an accident any old time. But instead,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
he kind of destroys him from within by making him
That's
question
right.
everything about his life and his, yeah, wife.
That's right. Yeah, it's one of the puzzles of interpretation of that play is why Iago. Well, the question, why does he hate Othello to begin with? And nobody can really answer that question. It's not really very clear in the play about why he hates Othello. But if he does hate him, yes, he could kill him. But that's not what Iago is interested in. I think the reason Iago's not interested in it, Iago has a kind of pride in his own intellectual powers. And to assert his intellectual power over Othello is more important to him than just to stab him in the back. That's not his style. He enjoys a sense of having this control over Othello's mind, and that means that he's a superior person to Othello mentally. And I think that is the main reason for it. I think a lot of people who are systematic liars have the same motivation. They realize that it takes a certain amount of skill to do it, and they just enjoy outwitting other people and deceiving other people. And sometimes I think they do it for its own sake. They may not even particularly value the aim of the lie, but the very act and process of it, they get a kick out of that.
I keep thinking about a different example, which is I keep thinking about all the paranoia in the 1950s about communist brainwashing. You know, there were films, all kinds of things about this fear that communists were secretly brainwashing innocent Americans. I guess kind of the modern military term would be psyops.
Yep.
So, which suggests maybe there's a kind of institutional MF.
Well, there can be, of course. The whole political system can be based on it. And communism is a good example. What people often think, though, is they make a mistake. They think other people are MF'd in other countries, but they're not MF'd at all. So all those people in communist Russia didn't think they were being MF'd. They thought the Americans were being MF'd. Because once you're within the worldview, once you're within the ideology, you take it to be true, of course. And then people who differ must differ because they're being manipulated to differ. So I think Americans at that time were, you know, very convinced that there was a lot of MF going on in communist Russia. But they weren't open to the possibility that maybe some was going on at home as well with propaganda. And each country is the same. I mean, you go to any different country and they all have their prevailing sets of beliefs, which they think are based on purely an objective fact. But there's all sorts of traditions and forces and special interests and so forth in these societies which shape opinion. I think everybody should ask themselves, whichever society they belong to, am I being MF'd about this, that or the other thing?
Well,
be sceptical.
It sounds like you would suggest that anytime we're part of a collective way of thinking, we're being MF'd. In that sense, we're all being MF'd.
I think it's probably no country in the world that's not somewhat MF'd by things. Because there's always some power base that's trying to manipulate the truth so as to serve its own interests. I mean, this is a Marxian view of capitalism, but even if you go to, you know, so-called primitive societies, there's some group there with special interests trying to persuade other people that they deserve, you know, most of the goats or most of the nuts or whatever it is that people covet in that society. Though, but I don't think it's a necessary truth. I mean, the institution of science, for example, at least aspires to be something in which you don't persuade people of scientific truth by MFing them. You have to give them the results of the experiments and the mathematical analysis and so forth. So I think it's not as if it's impossible for a human being to exist in a non-MFed state, but it's not easy. It's not easy to see through the clouds of MF into the objective validity of things.
Well, I guess that's what philosophy is for, right?
Philosophy is is one reason I like philosophy. Philosophy is a subject which is very sceptical, approaches any belief system and says, now, what exactly are the reasons for believing this? Let's try to articulate them. Let's see if they may not be as strong as we think. So Descartes, you know, the famous example, said, how can we justify our belief in the external world, even that we have a body? And he pointed out how difficult it is to do that. There are all sorts of reasons why that kind of belief that we have is not as rationally solid as we tend to think. So philosophy is something which is a kind of extreme opponent of the MF and is always on the lookout for it. So I think that's why many philosophers like Jean-Paul Sartre, Bertrand Russell, many others are often critics of their societies because they're trying to get beyond, you know, the belief systems which have arisen through non-rational mechanisms.
Yes, but I mean, not to get too tricksy here, but a lot of philosophers then get accused of MFing with people when in fact they're trying to point out the way in which everybody already is MF'd.
Exactly, and you'd have to look at it case by case. There may be some philosophers who do MF other people, but they may not. I mean, one good way to get out of being accused of MFing somebody is to accuse somebody else of MFing you. You get these reciprocal dependencies, you know, where one person says, you're MF. No, you're MF. I'm not the one that's MF. So you get who's being manipulated and who isn't. So the postmodernist position, which I talk about in my book, says that the Platonic tradition is the MFing tradition, because it has this bogus notion of objective truth and truths of reason and validity and so forth. And this is really just a result of special interests like capitalism. So Plato is the ultimate MFer because he believes in the idea of objectivity and objective truth and those kinds of things. Of course, Plato says in reply, no, you've been MF'd by something else, and it's difficult to know. That's why it would be easier if, you know, MFing was something which had written on it MF, then you could see that it was MF, but unfortunately it isn't so. You've got to apply your mind to try to figure it out yourself.
But at this point, aren't you just making the term so big and so all-encompassing that it becomes meaningless? I mean, if you can apply it to anything?
No, you can't apply it to anything. It's got to be something in which the means of persuasion is something other than straightforward evidence and reason. That's not MF, so we're not including that. I mean, if somebody claims that, like a postmodernist, I think they're wrong to say that. But the point of the MF is that it's persuasion other than by rational means. But again, it's a little bit narrower than that too, because I think that the idea is it's not just an act of persuasion where you don't go by the facts. It's more the more extreme idea of trying to disorient people, manipulate them into doing something against their interests and so forth. So I think when the word was invented, I think it had much more of that kind of intention behind it. So it was the specific kind of manipulation of opinion which leads to a rather deep disturbance in the person, often something which can be very harmful to the person. So, I think there are degrees of MFing, you could say, and so at one extent there's the extreme case, and then the other level is a relatively benign kind of case.
Mm. Well, at the milder end of the spectrum, there are professions now in which people get paid large amounts of money to create more and more MFs. I'm thinking of advertising, of course. Do you think that there is more MFing now than there has been in the past?
I think there is more, and the reason really has to do with the growth of media. There's just more means for manipulating people. I think television has been one of the great MF inventions of all time. But advertising, of course, is, as you say, another case of it. Although advertising sometimes gets a bad rap. There's nothing wrong with telling people what products you have and sell it to them. It's just the means you use to do that. I think there's quite a bit more. I think the internet has really intensified it, because people now, reading many hours a day and looking at their screens, and they're much more easily manipulated because there's no quality control in the kind of rhetoric that they're being fed. So there's a lot of it going on. But on the other hand, the point I'm making in my book, because there's a multiplicity of voices, one voice can try to question another. So somebody comes up with something and say on the internet, some conspiracy theory, let's say, and another person can come along and try to puncture that. Whereas I think in the old days, when there was more of a monopoly on the means of persuasion, of course, all totalitarian states want the monopoly of the media, then you don't have the opportunity for competition between different sources of information. So on the other hand, there's more because there's more media. On the other hand, it dilutes the effect because there's this competition.
Hmm. I'm curious about how thinking and writing about MFing may have affected your own interactions with people personally. Has it had any impact?
I'm not sure that it has. I mean, I think I'm actually probably quite a gullible person despite this. I'm very easily persuaded by what people say to me if I trust them, and I found myself in hot water more than once from doing that. I'm far too trusting of people. Maybe that's why that was my ultimate reason for getting interested in it. So I tend to take people at face value, and I'm taken in by them quite often, and sometimes people will say to me, that person isn't really as trustworthy as you seem to think, and I'll defend them to the hilt and so forth, and then I'm subsequently shown to be wrong. I don't know whether it's improved my ability to be critical, but I suppose I've articulated a little bit more. I mean, I'm very reluctant to give up my trusting nature. I think living as a cynic is a very disagreeable thing. But I suppose that, you know, I've had to give it up to some degree.
Well, on the other hand, I think you have a great deal of company, since we're all MF to one degree or another.
We're all MF to one degree or another, exactly. And we should ask ourselves, you know, which are the good kinds that we've been MF'd, which are the bad ones? Have we been led in certain prejudices, you know, by this kind of, by indoctrination, brainwashing, whatever we're going to call it, and examine those prejudices? And I think that many times, of course, people realize as they go through their lives that something they believed earlier, they now realize is mistaken. I think the great example of our current time is homosexuality, which has gone from being completely demonized when I was a young man, let's say, now being very widely accepted. I think everybody thinks, oh, why did I ever think homosexuality was such a terrible thing? Now that I've thought about it clearly, I don't really see much of an objection.
Thank you so much for talking today.
My pleasure.